Okay. Well, after I did my presentation, I got to thinking about some of the ambiguities in the lesson. So I thought maybe what I would do is start out by explaining something to you first. The difficulty is, well, first of all, I'll say the difficulty is in our day and age that we have moved from a creationist society that pretty well ended in the intelligentsia about 1800, 1850. They were so strong, the skeptics were so strong in their scientific discoveries that were supposedly unbiased, that for the next 100 years, 150 years, the Christians adjusted their theology to match with what was science. Then comes along John Whitcomb, 1960 approximately. He wrote the Genesis flood, and that was a challenge to the humanism, materialism, evolutionary philosophy, and it's sort of set the world on fire. Well, since then, 1960, I don't know, you could probably, I've not done this, I've taken too much work, but there's been an increasing amount of literature from the creationist point of view that is getting better and better and better, because for 100 or 150 years, you know, the Christians sort of just gave up the battle, succumbed to the scientists, and didn't ever argue a creationist point of view. Well, there's so many problems with the evolutionary point of view that Christians like John Whitcomb and a host of other people now, names that you don't even recognize, and I don't either, are writing now to establish again their presence in the scientific community, although somewhat ignored by them, but yet really not. Because as a Christian scientists or Christians who start with a creationist point of view become more established, they make some waves, and now we've had a backlash of the new atheists. The new atheists are really aiming at the creationists. So we have this intellectual fight that's going on, which is really, really healthy. Don't mind that a bit. So all saying all that to say this, that we are just kind of now, I feel, kind of catching up to where we should have been 100 years ago. So there's things that you read an older author, and then you read a newer author, and you see that some adjustments are being made in the creationist model that puts me in a spot where what's right. I mean, you sort of don't want to get too far out on a limb and make some statements and find out later on that that wasn't right, because there's some new research done, and we can tweak the model a little bit. We're still taking creation, flood, Tower of Babel, all that still stays in place. So we have the question of the flood. We're worked up to it now. We're in time worked up to it. Last week we worked on the morality that led to the necessity of the flood, God's destruction of the earth as it was known. So we're working up to it, and what we want to do today, the civilizations before the flood. And here's where it gets kind of fuzzy, because sometimes you don't know whether the civilization that's being looked at is before the flood or after the flood. And the problem we sometimes have with the flood, we sort of think of it somewhat like they do when they teach it in the second grade. You know, one day God sent a lot of water on the earth, and Noah and his family and animals got in the boat. They floated up, and they floated around for a year. Got off the boat, saw the rainbow, and went back to work. About that quick. But the real reality is, when there was such an upheaval in the world's atmosphere, its climate, its stability, even land masses, that took a long time, apparently, for the world to settle down again to find some kind of equilibrium. And during this time, we still would have had volcanoes go off. We still would have had flooding of sorts, local floodings, a hostile environment, and much more difficult than it was before the flood. Yep.
Can you define long time?
Long time? What sentence did I use that in? What context?
After Noah got off the boat, it took a long time for things
okay.
to settle.
All right. I'm going to say probably 1,000 years. Because by the time you get down to David, when he writes as if the world is stable. The oceans have their banks. God has established them. The mountains have already risen, and the valleys have already fallen. So you get a sense, when David writes 1000 BC, that we've somewhat come to an equilibrium, a kind of equilibrium. The question is, are we? Have we even reached it today? Because we see, you know, it gets warmer and it gets cooler. We go through cycles, and of course it's been politicized to no end these days. And the worry is that the sea level is going to go up, you know, or it's going to, not going to worry too much about dropping. They always worry about growing, rising sea levels because people have beachfront property. It kind of destroys that. So what is normal? That's one of the questions we really don't know the answer for. We can say averages. We can say how what's the average temperature last 100 years. We can probably say that, but we can't say that's normal. So we don't really know what normal is. But we have, the world has come to a rather stable equilibrium. That's a redundancy. It's in equilibrium, more or less. Okay, so I'd say this, that we don't want to think that the flood was one cataclysmic event and, you know, after the flood was over, the water ran off in a couple of weeks and now it's the way it's always been. From the flood to equilibrium had to be a long, long time. Long time, 1,000 years. Now, these are guesses. Now, maybe in time, there are ways to measure some of these things, and if there's research done, you know, they do all this chemistry stuff and they find out how long certain chemicals are there, how much they have built up, and by that you can make some kind of estimate. So that's what they're saying today. Probably a long time, like 1,000 years. Now we think that 1,000 years from the flood, which brings you down to around the time of the Exodus, a little bit after the Exodus. We have no idea what was going on in North America during the time of Exodus, do we? We know what was going on in Egypt. We know what was going on in the Sinai Peninsula. We know what was going on in Israel. And there seems to be no particularly climatic events going on there, but we have no idea what's going on in the polar caps or how much flooding or how much ice melt was going on some other part of the world, because they're what's called lower latitude elevation, you know, around the world. You talk about the latitudes being the middle. So these are middle, upper. So these lower latitude elevation, or in the elevations of the world, are pretty much stable in the middle around the equator, that section. It's only you get past that half point going up to the poles that you start seeing these other phenomena. So it took me a while, and I'm not done learning, by the way. I was always kind of skeptical of the Ice Age, and very skeptical of Ice Ages. Well, I think I'm going to have to agree that there was an ice age, because the good scientists, from creationist point of view, say there was a ice age, and they give these reasons. Maybe we'll have a little more discussion about this when we actually go through this. So we're going to assume there was an ice age. Now, there are hundreds of theories of how this ice age happened. And we were talking before about, Larry was saying were you saying about South Dakota? Where's the town? Lead. Yeah, Lead has a glacier now. Because the guy walked out his back door and he tried to get out because the snow was over his door.
Whole town's under.
Okay, that's not a glacier. What does glacier have to do every year? No.
Stay there.
What?
Stay there.
Stay there, right. It has to survive the summer. And it has to survive a lot of summers and build up a lot during the wintertime. And that's exactly the problem the uniformitarianism people have, because they look at how it is today. There is no way under God's heaven that there'd ever be a glacier formed with the cold ocean to do a little evaporating and the relatively cold polar regions, which are very dry. You know, it never snows when it's cold, right? And we had the old saying we used to say, it's too cold to snow. My dad used to say that, and then we had snow. But it's a different kind of snow. You know, it's fluff, you know. So it's too cold to snow. The principle is there's so little water in the cold atmosphere that when it does precipitate out, it hardly amounts to anything. So it doesn't build up in the wintertime to the extent that it won't melt in the summer. And if it melts every summer, you'll never have a glacier. All right, so what I'll put on the board here for you is how did they form? Because it becomes an issue for our discussion on these civilizations, because some of these civilizations, I'm never going to get to my lesson, some of the civilizations could have been post-flood, even, and they're underwater. Some of the ashfall destruction, like we've had in what's it, Nebraska? Royal Nebraska. By the way, if you've never been there, it's worth a trip. It's the best whole carcass animal. These are fossils, right? Yeah, they're fossils. In the world. I mean, you think, well, you go there, they're all... No, in the rest of the world, you get parts. You get a leg, you get an arm, you get a head. There you get the whole thing. So an ashfall there, that's called ashfall, don't know, it could be post-flood. You know, and I was thinking it was pre-flood because of the tropical animals there, and that's still a question. How long did these animals survive in these areas that we now see as cold? Some of those answers maybe we'll get later on. So there were things that were going on after the flood that still could have caused the thing that we might attribute to the flood. So how did the glacier one era or period form? Well, you have sea level. I call it post-flood sea level. I don't know what number that is. No one knows. But it was very hot. Why was it hot? Because a lot of the water was heated by substrata, lava, boiling up into the water and cooking it. 100-degree water is pretty, it's comfortable to touch, right? It's not hot, called tepid, I guess. But 100 degrees ocean water is hot, because you know what it is today? It's 40, average temperature. And the ocean rolls. You know, the hot water goes to the top, cold water goes down, it just freezes, it comes back to the top, and that's why ice floats. So we have this churning over in the water of for centuries. This hot water becomes a source of, ocean water becomes a source for evaporative water. They'll go into the atmosphere. You know, hot water evaporates a lot quicker than cold water. All right, so that's where we begin. We begin with some kind of sea level. We have an evaporation that's a high-level evaporation. Well, I have two things. Like, this is sort of a side view of it, and then we see it looking down from the top if you watch the Weather Channel. But if this goes up and it cools down, what does it become? Becomes clouds. And I'm just going to make the drift over here to the pole, and it's going to reach cold air. And when hot, moist clouds hit cold air, what happens? It either rains or it snows. If you're in upper latitudes, it's going to snow. It's going to snow a bundle. Remember these, you can't go by what it is today, because much warmer air, much more warmer water rising in warm air going over to a colder era drops the water, and it forms a glacier because it goes year after year. It doesn't melt during the summertime. There's that much water, and it stays cool. All kinds of reasons why it might have stayed cool, because the volcanic ash cools down, and northern latitudes would be, you know, areas where it would be cold. All right, so that goes on for hundreds of years. Somewhere along the way, this warmth, this energy is dissipated, warmth, and it starts to cool off. Well, when it cools off, it doesn't generate the water for the clouds, for the snow, and the sun apparently isn't blocked, so the world starts warming up. Now, all of a sudden, we start having the glaciers, instead of being built up, they start melting. Not in one year does it all disappear, but little bit by little bit. In fact, are they still up there? Yes, they are. And the environmentalists are worried that they're going to melt totally away because of what we're doing to them. Well, maybe not, but they are melting. least in the last few years, last 15-year cycle, they've been melting. Now the question is, are they going to continue to melt? Or are we in some kind of equilibrium where we're going to go to a cycle where there's going to be more snowfall and going to build back up again? We don't know that. So anyway, let's get to the point where the glaciers are starting to melt some. Well, what does melted water do? It causes rivers and even causes local floods. And where does the water finally end up? In the ocean. It is assumed, figured out by these guys, that as much as 200 foot of sea level could have occurred, rise of sea level could have occurred in this melting cycle. So we have sea level as it is today. Because we go and see, we'll show you, tell you about it, civilizations that are under sea level. And that's how they got there. So there was a glacier and it did melt. Now how many times? We don't know. Now just think about how this happened. When the water's down here, these guys built their oceanside resorts. You know, the ocean view. And these buildings are made of stone. They don't last like our wood-built buildings. They last for years, sometimes centuries. The pyramids are still standing. Stone buildings continue to stand. All right. So in the meantime, they become inhabitable. People don't usually live underwater. So they move out and abandon them, move up to higher ground. So then we go look and see them there. So now the question is, are these pre-flood or post-flood? Well, we maybe don't know. Because just because they're underwater, under sea level, doesn't mean necessarily they're pre-flood. They could just as well be post-flood. And maybe somebody's going to come along and help us understand which is which. Now, for our hemisphere, in our western hemisphere, the way the storm track works, you watch this on Weather Channel, it comes off the Pacific, the storms always form out here, and they move in, and you usually take some kind of track, depending on what track you're on. But the most productive track for glaciers is this track that heads up the eastern shore. And guess what comes in from this side? They're called hurricanes. And the hurricanes that could have been functioning in those days could have been horrendous. Because remember, hurricanes, I always say, are going to die off when they hit before cold water. Remember, we talk about energy, you can't destroy energy. So this energy is in the water, and as long as the energy is in the water, is there, it fuels these hurricanes. And they talk about 100 mile an hour updraft, 300 mile an hour circular velocity. These are huge hurricanes. Kick up a lot of water. You know, we have in New Orleans, I don't know how many inches an hour it would fall, but we say today, I think a half inch an hour is considered heavy rainfall. But they're talking about 6 inches an hour. So, okay, we have a huge amount of moisture coming up from here and from there and along the eastern core, and then shore, it goes up, and low pressures turn this way, and it dumps it into the cool area, and the glaciers are formed. I was going to look up where the 37th latitude is. Anybody parallel is? You know how far down that is? Anybody? Isn't it Canada 40? 47? Well, I know the Korean War was on the 38th parallel. Remember that. So that would be approximately where this glacier came down. 37th is what they figure. And I think that would be down even as far as Nebraska, I think. That northern Nebraska that we'd consider. Okay. All right. So we had this kind of a pattern like that where the glacier came. All right. I thought that would take 50 minutes. It took 20. And I got an hour worth of lesson to go. So, all right, sort of get the idea here. What we're kind of dealing with is that we don't know for sure whether we're looking at pre-flood stuff or post-flood stuff. And we maybe can't decide for sure. But in time, I think this is going to be more or less sorted out.
What you're saying, basically, is our problem with melting glaciers today is not global warming, but global cooling. Because When the globe was hot, we had glaciers.
Well, the thing of it is there's no way that glaciers formed today. I mean, to the extent that they were.
Yeah, except the water heat up.
Right, well, that's never going to happen.
I agree.
Okay.
So global cooling.
Yeah. The problem from getting more glaciers or problems that we have too many glaciers. So, It's not possible. They cannot build a model with today's uniformitarianism ideas. That's always been the way it's always been. They can't build a model out of that to make this happen. And every model that the uniformitarianism people have always excludes the flood. Not one of them includes the flood. It solved their problem. Make their day. They could be famous. Just include the flood. And then look at it from a science point of view, and lo and behold, maybe it'll tell you something. Teach you something. All right. Okay. Got that all down now. I did not have any questions, right? We're not going to wait for this, but we are waiting. Okay, and get through these first slides. You've seen this before. This is basically our timeline we're following. Creation is 404 BC, 4400 BC, approximately. And we're talking about the Genesis flood. Last time we talked about the timeline, talked about the time that it took for the world to be populated from AM was Anno Mundi, from the first of the creation. Jews still figure their time that way. To the flood, 1656 years. Really not that hard to remember. 1600, 5, 6, 1, 6, 5, 6. This one's really easy to remember. 2, 3, 4, double it, it got 8. All right, so easy. You got to do that, you'll never remember otherwise. That's BC, by the way. So the question is, are there antediluvian, which means before the flood, civilizations? Question mark. In other words, lost civilizations. And I just gave you the caveat on this lesson here. The material in this lesson is based on some subjective elements. It is true for anything but the Bible that there is subjectiveness in it. But the issues to keep in mind in this lesson and the next, which is going to be the Neanderthal man, not the Thrall man, and Neanderthal man. So we'll talk about a civilization, then we'll talk about the man next time, not next week, next time. And very closely related, because civilization includes man, right? So maybe some overlap. So we're going to study the Neanderthal man. Okay, keep in mind, in this lesson and the next, is the dating of the evidence. Was it a civilization before the flood or was it after? It is likely that most after-the-flood civilizations are quite self-evident. Yet some may not be determinable. And herein is our warning. So the first question is, are there civilizations? And we ask the question, is it plausible? And we say yes. Why? Well, for one thing, they existed. I should have put that in bold. The Bible says they existed. You know, like, well, maybe they didn't exist. They existed. All right, so there's possibly some evidence somewhere, because we do see evidence from before the flood. Think of our oil deposits. Think of our coal deposits. Just those things alone are evidence of a flood. So this issue of plausibility is not guessing, by the way. Plausibility is appearing worthy of belief. The synonyms are credible, credibility, likely, believable, presumptive, probable, the opposite, far-fetched, implausible, improbable, incredible, unbelievable, unlikely, unplausible, which all is describing the evolutionary model. Now, an evidence of a flood. Look at the carbon on Earth. The amount of carbon on Earth. Remember, carbon comes from growing material. Carbon comes from growing material. Today, by the way, these numbers are explained down here, how big they are, where it's right there. Each unit is 10 times the 12th kilograms of carbon, so don't worry about that. You'd have to add 12 zeros behind that, so obviously truncate that. So just look at the relationship. That's where the issue here. Look at these in the atmosphere, the 720 in our soil and surface. In peat around the world, wood and vegetation, we have ocean surface layer. We have immediate ocean layer on the surface. Surface layer, then intermediate ocean layer, which is below the surface. And we have the deep ocean carbon. And then we have the carbonate sediments, would be our oil reserves, oil and coal. Look at the difference here. You add these all up, you have, what did I say, 40, 1,000 compared to 20 million. Now, these are the, we'd call man-made, hardly any of these are even man-made. So can you see how little man actually contributes to the amount of carbon that's released in the atmosphere or is in the world? So we have a lot of carbon in the world, and where did it come from? It came from growing material. All right, so coal doesn't get made today. Oil doesn't get made today, so it had to come from another era, from another world, another time. All right, evidence that there was a pre-flood civilization, because these things exist. This last one exists. Well, go outside and make a little trip to the Grand Canyon like we did this last year. We see the scarred earth. Mountains, the warped, bent, vertical rock plains or strata, all visible rock is sedimentary rock. See these kind of things in the Grand Canyon, world over, these warp planes. Obviously, there was hot melt molten at one time, got molt, folded back and then cooled. You have this kind of famous picture. If you have Windows 7, that shows up on your Windows 7 screensaver, or wallpaper, I guess they call it. So you have these evidences that there was a civilization. So, plausible, yes. Reason, they existed. Second, perhaps reason, this is a guessing reason, God destroyed the earth, yes, but left a witness of an earlier earth, which would make sense. You know, if the Bible says there was an early civilization, why shouldn't we not be able to see it or see evidences of it? But we may not have a time stamp. That makes it more difficult. There are difficulties, of course, but reasonableness, plausibility can be established. On the contrary, the public funding for research is controlled by the skeptics who do not believe in the biblical record, are biased against supernaturalism. All scientists, Christian and otherwise, make mistakes. Over-exuberant Christians do as well, and we've got to watch that. You find some new finds. Oh, boy, this is the answer, you know, like the Noah's Ark. Oh, now everybody will believe. Well, maybe it wasn't the Noah's Ark, like these people from China faked their evidence and didn't find it at all. So we got to be a little careful that we don't get too excited because we find something that doesn't necessarily prove anything because we could have been wrong, but it could have been mistaken. So just got to be careful. Some humanist evolutionists intentionally lie or fabricate or distort, that is to ignore evidence that fit their Unitarian, uniformitarian model of evolution. So they're prone to error when their bias is in the beginning of research. So how can people that are so biased actually come to the truth? And I have read actual people throw away evidence that doesn't conform to their model because they say, well, it just must have been damaged, so we just throw it away. But you don't know that. You get it out and say, oh, look at all this evidence. It's all for, you know, evolution. So we may not know for certainty from archaeology or paleontology, but we do know that the Bible provides truthful, unbiased information. This is sufficient to set the general framework. No matter what the scientist says, no matter whoever says, we know these things in the Bible, these five things we talked about happened, and that does explain the world as we know it today. So we agree, I mean everybody and their pet mouse, that these civilizations existed. Civilizations are lost in terms of not having a clear date stamp. You know, they're lost because we don't know, they're not lost like, well, sometimes we're lost, we don't know where they are. But they're lost because we don't know where they really fit. There's no date stamp. There's no state, over the courthouse, you know, built in 1934. So we know that date. But we don't have anything like that. For one thing, there's no calendar like that available. No one used such a calendar. Jews did, but other people tended to make calendars based on the kings. That's what you have in Egypt, the trouble with finding the chronology in Egypt, because everybody dated their kings according to the certain year of the certain king's reign. Once you ever, you know, give me a reign of the beginning of the earth, and then tell me where he fits. So there are mistakes being made. So we have that... We have to agree, we think, they have to agree, that there was a catastrophe or an event that caused all the civilizations to be lost. Now, uniformitarianism, evolutionism, chafes at the idea of catastrophism. It's too much like the flood, I guess. Yet they haven't been forced to accept catastrophic events to explain our world, and they say, well, they were just local catastrophes. Like this whole thing about the flood, the glacier flood, the book that I've referred to quite a bit, The Fingerprints of God. He talks about the flood throughout the book, but continues to say it was caused by the glacier. So he regards catastrophes, but they were local catastrophes, because he says that there's no evidence for a worldwide flood. I wonder what's wrong with my mind. But there are other renegades, and he's one of them, just Graham Hancock. There are renegades who allow catastrophe. We will see such in this Fingerprints of God later on, Lord willing. So all agree that water played a significant part in the loss or destruction of civilization. Now, the secular humanists suggest a slow ice buildup at the poles and global warming, thawing the ice which produced rivers of great floods. I still don't quite understand how they can suppose that. You know, rivers, water comes down and makes rivers, and usually it can walk away from rivers, and ice usually doesn't melt that fast, and there's some warning. So how these catastrophes could have occurred so suddenly, I don't understand with this ice melt. But they assume, and the best thinking these days, because it's the latest thinking, is that these ice ages occurred every 100,000 years. That's a comfortable number. You know, it's not too big, it's not too small. It's small enough you could have a lot of them in the age of the Earth, supposedly. And yet it's not so often that you could actually measure it. So they are forced to acknowledge the change in sea levels and credit the melting ice for the rise of the sea. Well, we have some agreement with that, except for the mechanism by which these glaciers were formed. And I got thinking about our last election cycle, and it says that all it takes to change sea levels is to get the right man elected to office. And that, he said in 2008, that at that moment was the moment when the rise of the ocean began to slow and the planet is beginning to heal. I thought, what arrogance is there when someone could say that? Okay, this is a little diagram to just show this, because we have pre-flood and post-flood observations. Okay? So we don't know where we are exactly. So I get on the internet and I start looking for stuff. And you know, it's always dangerous to be on the internet, because you know, get into some stuff that's kind of weird. This is a popular site, about.com. He says there are 10 most intriguing mysteries of lost civilizations. So I thought, well, just find out what the world says out there about what these lost civilizations are and how they are described. Well, in his 10, the first 9 could have been pre-flood civilization. I doubt maybe one of them might not be. But 10 seems to be of a different quality altogether, because the man that records the 10th vision is one in which he had a vision. Okay? That doesn't seem like that ought to be countable. By the way, this is Petra back here. I should probably not have used that. So, but anyway, it looks like a lost civilization. But we know about Petra in Jordan. So he says, this is Stephen Wagner, how can we know who we are if we don't know where we come from? See, we know that answer. It is clear from many fragments of evidence, tradition, and lore that we have an incomplete picture of the early stages of human civilization. I would say, you don't have it. We have something of a clue. You don't. All right. It is possible, he said, that whole civilizations have, with advanced technology, have come and gone. At the very least, now again, this is against uniformitarianism. You know, you can't have advanced technology down here and progress to humanity up here. You know, so we have these renegades that come out and argue against humanity, evolution, although they don't really probably adopt the creationist model. But they said, we've had advanced cultures, and they're down here. No, not really. Now, it says that here, the advanced technology have come and gone, and at very least human culture reaches much further back than time than conventional history admits. What's another word for conventional history? Scholarship. What's accepted by the norms, what's being taught in the classrooms. They don't accept this. But it's possible, this man says. There are many mysteries of the ancient past, but there may be clues to the past around the world in the form of sunken cities, ancient structures, cryptic hieroglyphics, artwork, and more. All right, we're not going to get done. That's okay. What's the first word?
Evidence.
It didn't all get on there, did it? Forget it. Number one of his 10, we should have done this backwards, should be the most interesting. Number one on his list, this is one I did not know about, and it is a little bit questionable, but this is what was reported in 1909, the edition of the Arizona Gazette, where the Grand Canyon is, featured an article entitled Exploration in the Grand Canyon. Remarkable finds indicate ancient people migrated from Orient. According to the article, the expedition was financed by the Smithsonian Institute and discovered artifacts that would, if verified, stand conventional history scholarship on its ear. Inside a cavern, hewn in solid rock by human hands, were found tablets of bearing hieroglyphics, copper weapons, statues of Egyptian deities and mummies. Now, the Smithsonians had disavowed all knowledge of this discovery, and several expeditions searching for the cavern have come up empty-handed. So I got to leave that one a little bit open. But it wouldn't surprise me if the Smithsonians would like to discount it because it goes against their model. So we leave that where it is. Finishing up on the Egyptian guy here, most Egyptologists believe that the Great Sphinx on the Giza Plateau is about 4,500 years old, but that number is just that, a belief, a theory, not a fact. Bavald says the age of the Sphinx, there is no inscription, not a single one, either carved on a wall or a stela or written on the thongs of papyri that associated the Sphinx with this time period. So when was it built? John West challenged the accepted age of the monument when he noted the vertical weathering on the base, which could only have been caused by long exposure to water in the form of heavy rain in the midst of the desert. Where did the water come from? You know, I didn't know that. We did a section on Egypt two years ago, whenever we came back. And there's been a lot of work by Christian chronologists have, you know, sort of got a better chronology than has been accepted. They all accepted pyramids from the time of Abraham, and they may be. What we said is true. And I've read this other place. There's nothing in the pyramids that date them. It's so different than when you go to the Valley of the Kings. They've got their names scribbled all over the place. You know, and they decided that the Sphinx was made by the king. I won't say his name right, so I won't even say it. But they found a statue of him in one of the digs around the pyramid, in one of the basement digs around the pyramid. And that's about all they've got. And you think, these guys, when you show up there and the Egyptian guides tell you all the truth about the pyramids, and they're just talking guesses. You know, and I'm going to do this later on, but there's a place where I've read about how many stones there are in the pyramids and how much they weigh on average. How often, how many of those you'd have to put in place every minute in order for them to be built in 20 years. It's impossible. So we have a situation we can't explain. No one has been explained the pyramids. So then you get to think, well, did they get built before the flood by some way that we have no idea how they were done? Maybe before the pyramids were built, stone floated. I don't know. But we don't know. We don't know. And what we say we know, we really don't know. But you got to say something, especially if you're a tour guide. So the age of the pyramids and the Sphinx could have been built first, the pyramids have been built later. Don't know. So it happens that this era of the world experienced such rains. Now, they used it off to come with this 10,000-year age, which they just take off a couple of zeros, but get it back to biblical terms, but they usually use this number. That many years ago, that would make the Sphinx more than twice its current accepted age. Hancock has calculated the Great Pyramids likewise dated back to about 10,500 BC, predating the Egyptian civilization. This raises the question, who built them and why? And we say, how? Then we have how do you say this name? Nazca? Is that Nazca? Nazca, whatever. But if you don't know, then just make one up. These are the lines that are south of Lima, Peru on the plain. They measure 37 miles long and 1 mile wide. Are etched lines, figures that have puzzled the scientific world since their discovery in 1930. The puzzle is that these lines and figures are of such scale that they can only be recognized at high altitude. They're recognized by accident in 1930 by an overflying airplane. So what is the significance? Some believe they have astronomical purposes. astronomical purposes, while others think they served as religious ceremonies. The recent theories suggest the lines lead to the sources of precious water. They really don't know. Location of Atlantis. Boy, this has been around for a while. If we get to the legend of Atlantis from Plato, who wrote about the beautiful, technologically advanced continent-shaped, continent-sized island back in 370 BC, but his description of the location was limited and vague. Many, of course, conclude that Atlantis never really existed, but was merely a fable. Those who would think that it did exist have sought evidence, at least clues, in almost every corner of the globe. Now, here's one of those kind of things. If there's a legend out there that something existed, there's probably some reason why it is a legend. There's something back there where it got started. You know, it started because it was believable in the beginning. Now, maybe it gets changed over time, but it was the beginning was believable. So some of these legends, we just don't want to write off and say, well, they're just legends. No truth to them at all. Now, the location of Atlantis, who knows where they are? They've been everywhere in the world, been suggested. Now, I have the Mayan calendar. This is from Central America. There's a lot of hand-wringing going on over these prophecies. You know, most people fear it perhaps more than the Lord. The prediction of the catastrophic the year of 2000, all the fretting is based on finding the Mayan long count calendar, which ends on a date that corresponds to our December 21, 2012. What does it mean? I'd say not much. Not certainly the end of the world. But anyway, what the point is, there was a civilization that had calculated, had the ability to make this calendar. Now, it wasn't the Mayans. They called the Mayans because they were the one, I suppose, that had it when they were caught, so to speak. The Mayans were unremarkable in their achievements, says Thompson, 1954. Yet they possessed an advanced astrocalendrical knowledge. He asked, what mental quirks led the Maya intelligentsia to chart the heavens, yet failed to grasp the principles of the wheel, to visualize eternity as no other semi-civilization, and I thought about the Jews, forgot about them, have ever done, yet ignore the short step from a corbelled to a true arch. That's corbelled, that's true arch. They did this, but they couldn't do that. To count in the millions, never learn to weigh a sack of corn. But these are the guys that invented the Mayan calendar? Probably not. They got it from somewhere else. Perhaps they were the constituent parts of a coherent but very specific body of knowledge that the Maya had inherited, more or less intact from an older civilization. Skipping the rest. We have the underwater Japanese ruins. I can't read you all these things. But off the coast of Japan, one of the islands is this offshore, now becomes a diver's destination. You were shocked to see a massive arch, gateway, huge stones, block, beautifully fitted together in a manner of prehistoric masonry found among the Incas, cities on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, in the Andes Mountains in South America. Now, this one could qualify for this because it's only about 200 feet down. So this could have been one of those post-flood civilizations. And you've seen some of this on TV. And some say, oh, this is not man-made. So you see right angles like that and straight lines like that, and you get a couple of them together, you know it's man-made. Skipping this. This is where it's located off of Taiwan, right there. Oh, we have these Enderon. Let's see if I can get through this real quick. These are extra ones. This, I think, is probably, the first part's probably post-flood. We talk about Columbus discovered America. And what they meant to teach us, however, was that Columbus began the official European invasion of Americas. People had discovered the continent long before. Columbus, of course, was known as Native Americans arrived here many centuries before, maybe when the ocean was lower and they could walk across the Bering Strait on dry ground. I got to look that up. I don't think there's more than 200 feet of water through the Bering Strait from Alaska to Russia because they wanted to build a bridge over that. That will be some bridge and some money. The reason they can't build it is because icebergs go through there. They can't build anything strong enough to stop those icebergs. Anyway, so we have these coming across at that time when the sea level was lower, and it explains how the people got here. Artifacts are found, and this is interesting, the most interesting part. Egyptian statue of Orus and Iris were found in Mexico, to say nothing of the Grand Canyon discovery above, ancient Hebrew and Asian artifacts have been found. The truth is we know very little about the early far-traveling cultures. So I say these are Hebrew and Asian artifacts. Hebrew artifacts for sure. It has to be then post-flood. This is a new one to me. Sunken city off of Cuba in 2001. An exciting discovery was made by Advanced Digital Communication, a Canadian company that was mapping the ocean bottom of Cuba's territorial waters. Sonar readings revealed something unexpected and quite amazing. At 2,200 feet, this is now way, way more than our 200 feet. Where are we here? 2,200 feet. Stones laid out in geometric pattern. It looked very much like ruins of a city. What we have here is a mystery. Sunken city. We're going to skip all that. And then another one. And this last one was the guy where he sighted something that we use in a vision. Can't count that. Okay. I'm going to do some of this. We may can't do all of it. I'm doing a lot of reading for him, sorry, tonight. But I want to get this over with, so I don't have to come back to it. This guy spends his whole book, 500 pages long, proving or showing that there are civilizations that are ancient. And they're fascinating. If you like to read this kind of stuff, it's fascinating. He doesn't make it up. He goes kind of contrary to accepted scholarship. Well, when you do that, you don't get a lot of recognition for that. But it's worth reading, I think. One of the chapters that we're going to cite from is called, in the front of the chapter, it says, "The face of the earth was darkened and a black rain began to fall." If I say this, I'm not going to have time to read any of this stuff. There is a theory that I have about how this stuff gets transmitted. There are 8 people got on the boat, right? 8 people got off the boat. 8 people, only 8 people, survived the flood. They knew about the flood. They experienced, Noah lived 600 years. Shem. Is that right? Yeah, Shem. I always get this mixed up with Adam's son. Shem was born about 98 BC, before the flood. So he was 100 years old approximately at the flood. So we have some adult children living through the flood and knew the world before the flood. I think that they talked about what happened to their people, their children, their grandchildren, and they lived another hundreds of years, that they gave information about the world before the flood to other people. It was more than what we have in our Bible. This information gets spread across the world. It becomes some of the legends that we have. Okay? No other way could it come. Because rocks don't talk, trees don't talk, you know, but people do. And we know the Tower of Babel was a time when the world was sort of in a pile, and they were scattered because they were too much in a pile, and when they took their, and some of them were hostile to God, and they took their information, and some of them twisted it, and they went to the four corners of the earth with their information. And some of that is what we find back reading these books. Okay, so we have terrible forces were unleashed on the living creatures during the last ice age. I say that's what he says. We may deduce how these or this affected humanity from the firm evidence of their consequences and the large, and for other large species, you know, the ones that survived. Often this evidence looks puzzling, as Charles Darwin observed after visiting South America. He says, "No one, I think, can have marveled more at the extinction of the species than I have done. When I found in La Patria, Argentina, the tooth of a horse embedded with the remains of a mastodon and those other guys, other extinct monsters, which all coexisted at the very late geological period. No one, I think, can have marveled more at the extinction of species than I have." Read that. There we go. "I was filled with astonishment for seeing that the horse, since its introduction by the Spaniards in South America, has run wild over the whole country, and it has increased its number in an unparalleled rate. I asked myself, what could have so recently exterminated the former horses under conditions of life apparently so favorable?" So he sees these horses are exterminating, have no reason to understand why. The flood, Darwin. So, well, the answer, of course, is the Ice Age. No. That's what exterminated the former horses in the Americas and a number of other previously successful mammals. Nor were extinctions limited to the New World. Now, this is Hancock writing here. nor extinctions limited to the New World. On the contrary, in different parts of the earth for different reasons and for at different times. No, same time. Maybe some flooding here that might have caused some extinction, but not fossilization. Different reasons, different times, long epoch of glaciation witnessed several quite distinct episodes. Now, they're thinking cycles here, and we're not. In all areas, vast majority of many destroyed species were lost in the final 7,000 years from 15 down to 8,000. He's just got his dates wrong. Many thousands of species were destroyed at that time and were never recovered. That's what he said. Now, Noah took one of each of them on the ark. So Hancock says it is not necessary to establish specific nature of the climatic, seismic, and geological events linked to the various advances and retreats of ice sheets, which killed off the animals. He's saying, don't make me explain this glacier stuff. Let's just assume it happened. He says, no need to establish how this worked. It just happened. Well, no, excuse me. We got to be a little better off than that. We might reasonably guess that tidal waves, earthquakes, gigantic windstorms, sudden onset of remission of glacial conditions played their part. But more important, whatever the actual agency involves, he ducking it again, is a stark empirical reality of mass extinctions of animals did take place as a result of the turmoil in the last ice age. Just say the word flood. I know it hurts you, but try it. And this turmoil, as Darwin concluded in his journal, must have shaken the entire framework of the globe. In the New World, for example, more than 70 genera of large mammals became extinct between 715 and 8,000, including all North American members of seven families and one complete order of the Proboscidea. Are those the kind that have big noses? These staggering losses involved the violent obliteration of more than 40 million animals were not spread out evenly over the whole period. On the contrary, the vast majority of extinctions occurred in just 2,000 years. He's got his dates wrong again. To put this in perspective, during the previous 300,000 years, only 20 genera had disappeared. I don't understand if I agree with his disappearance of these species, because it says that Noah took them on the ark with them. But they're assuming that these species that they find in these big burial pits, there some are extinct today. But that doesn't mean they didn't live on for a while. So the same pattern of late massive extinction was repeated across Europe and Asia. Even far off Australia was not exempt, losing perhaps 19 genera of large vertebrates, not all of them mammals, in a relatively short period of time. See, he's recognizing something that the Bible says happened. Alaska and Siberia, the sudden freeze, the northern regions of Alaska and Siberia appear to have been the worst hit by the murderous upheaval of between 13,000 and 10,000 years ago, wrong dates. In a great swath of death around the edges of the Arctic Circle, the remains of uncountable numbers of large animals have been found, including many carcasses with the flesh still intact and astonishing quantities of perfectly preserved mammoth tusks. Indeed, both regions, mammoth carcasses have been thawed to feed sled dogs. Mammoth steaks have been featured on restaurant menus at Fairbanks. No, thank you. One authority has commented, hundreds of thousands of individuals must have been frozen immediately after death and remained frozen, otherwise the meat and ivory would have spoiled. Some powerful general force was certainly at work to bring this catastrophe about. I'm reading from the book.
It's only good rare.
Dale Guthrie of the Institute of Arctic Biology has made an interesting point about the sheer variety of animals that flourished in Alaska before the 11th century, whatever, B.C., 11,000 B.C. When learning of this exotic mixture of saber-toothed cats, camels, horses, rhinos, asses, deer, gigantic antlers, lions, ferrets, saiga, one cannot help wonder about the world in which they lived. We do, too. This great discovery of sea species so different from that encountered today raised the most obvious question. Is it not likely that the rest of the environment was also different? Yes, it was. See how close he gets? The Alaskan muck, mud, in which the remains are embedded is like a fine dark gray sand, frozen solid with this mass. In the words of Professor Hibben of the University of New Mexico, the twisted parts of animals, trees intermingled with lenses of ice, layers of peat, mosses, bison, horses, Wolves, bears, lions, whole herds of animals were apparently killed together, overcome by some common power. Such piles of bodies of animals and or men simply do not occur in any ordinary natural means. This is the guy writing this book who doesn't believe a flood occurred. At various levels, artifacts have been found frozen in situ, means in place, at great depths and associated with Ice Age fauna plants, which affirms that men were contemporary with extinct animals in Alaska. That's another problem they have. Evidence for atmospheric disturbances, unparalleled violence, mammoth and bison alike were torn, twisted as though by a cosmic hand in godly rage. It was his word. In one place, we find the foreleg, the shoulder of a mammoth, which with portions of the flesh and toenails and hair still clinging to the blackened bones. Close by is the neck and skull of a bison with the vertebrae clinging together with tendons and ligaments and the whatever that word is, covering of the horns. I think that's the covering on the horns. That's why I don't know anything about it, because I don't have horns. There is no mark of knife or cutting instrument as it would be for human hunters, for example. The animal is simply torn apart, scattered over the landscape like things of straw and string, even though some of them weighed several tons. Mixed with piles of bone are trees, also twisted and torn, piled and tangled groups. The whole is covered with a fine sifting muck in then frozen solid. Much of the same picture emerges in Siberia, where catastrophic climate changes and geological upheavals occurred at around the same time. Here, the frozen mammoth graveyards mined for their ivory since the Roman era, still yielding an estimated 20,000 pairs of tusks every decade at the beginning of the 20th century. Once again, some mysterious factor appears to have been at work in bringing about these mass extinctions. With the woolly coats and the thick skins, mammoths are generally considered adapted to cold weather, and we are not surprised to come across their remains in Siberia. Harder to explain is the fact that human beings perish alongside them, as well as many other animals. There is no sense that, in no sense, can be described as cold-adapted species. And we list all of them here. Researchers have confirmed that 34 animal species lived in Siberia prior to the catastrophe of the 11th millennium BC, included mammoth, deer, cave hyenas, lions. No less, 28 were adapted only to temperate conditions. They're out of the place. In this context, one of the most public aspects of the extinction, which runs contrary to what today's geographical climate conditions lead us to expect, is that further north one goes, the more mammoth and the other remains increase in number. Instead of getting less when you go north, it gets more. Indeed, some of the new Siberian islands, well within the Arctic Circle, were described by the explorers who first discovered them as being made up mostly of mammoth bones and tusks. The only logical conclusion is 19th century French zoologist Colivet said that this eternal frost did not previously exist in those parts which the animals were frozen, for they could not have survived in such a temperature. The same instant that these creatures were bereft of life, the country which they inhabited became frozen. There's a great deal of other evidence which suggests that a sudden freeze took place in Siberia during the 11th millennium BC. In a survey of the New Siberian Islands, the Arctic explorer Von Toll found the remains of the saber-toothed tiger and fruit trees that had been 90 feet tall when it was standing. The trees are well preserved in the permafrost with the roots and seeds. Green leaves, ripe fruit still hung to the branches. At the present time, the only representative of green vegetation on the island is a willow that now grows 1 inch tall. Equally indicative of the catastrophic change that took place at the onset of the great cold in Siberia is the food the extinct animals were eating when they perished. Mammoths died suddenly in intense cold in great numbers. Death came so quickly they swallowed vegetation instead of undigested. I just quit. This is from a guy who doesn't believe what the Bible says. He doesn't believe in the creation, in the flood, and yet he describes almost in detail the conditions that would come out of the Great Flood. Just has the dates wrong. Okay. You got enough? All right. Now, next week or next time, we will do the Neanderthal man. So we're not sure. I'm not sure exactly where he lives either. We could be before the flood, after the flood. I think what we're going to see, most of the Neanderthal are going to be post-flood men. They just didn't happen to wear suits. They didn't shave either, I don't think. But, you know, they didn't wear, you know, suits. So otherwise, they're going to be pretty much like us guys. So, or some of us guys. You know, like your next door neighbor, you know, the Neanderthal next to you. So, I mean, within range of humanity, they'll probably fit in that culture class.
You don't wear a suit.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad this is done because I want to do this last year and you see, last week, and I got that reading part done. I just figured if I just tell you about it, it'd just be kind of like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I figured if I read it to you, it seemed like more impact, but I don't like to read to you. But all right, we're done. I'll pray and let you go. Lord, thank you for the great time we have together these Wednesday nights, Lord, to look into the history of the earth, and we find it so compatible with what the Bible has said. Lord, we don't need the confirmation, but it's something we'd expect. We expect there's with all truth. There's no contradiction in what we read and what we see. Thank you, Lord. In all of this, you're doing your marvelous work in humanity. Lord, it's the fall occurred in a matter of moment, and yet it's been these millenniums to, again, restore the world to its rightful condition. Of course, necessitating so many things that have been in our history, and the most important would be your coming as a man and dying on the cross for our sins. Lord, realize that somehow that's the basis for all this redemption, whether it's our human life or whether it's the restoration of the world, to redeem it away from the hands of those that have claimed it as their own and return it to its rightful owner. Thank Lord for the prospect of the millennium. Someday we'll see the world as it was, and we'll probably look back on these days that these days of our wonder, and to be able to see firsthand how it was and have the questions we often ask answered more completely. Thank you, Lord, for these people, for taking time out of their week to come, and for Lord, you might continue to guide and direct us now as we go home and for the days that lie before us before we meet again. Pray, Lord, you might bless us all. In Jesus' name I pray it. Amen.